So again, thank you so much for being here tonight. We are so fortunate that one of America's most renowned artists, Sally Mann, has agreed to take time out of her busy life of home and studio in Lexington, Virginia, to be with us tonight to share her thoughts and experiences as represented in her most recent book, Hold Still, A Memoir with Photographs, published by Little Brown this year, 2015. For the sake of time, I will basically report from the brief bio found on the artist's website, on the book jacket, and elsewhere. But, of course, there is so much more. And being the devoted audience that I believe you to be, I'm sure that you, like myself, have scanned the internet to equip yourself for tonight's firsthand experience with Sally Mann. And I think probably a large number of you have at least dipped into the book, and I know many of you purchased it because we had a long line for the signing. I would like to state at this point that we scheduled the signing before the lecture so that we could be done tonight after the lecture, so please don't come up for signings after the lecture, okay? Sally Mann was born in Lexington, Virginia, where she continues to live and work on her family farm. She began to receive recognition as an artist with her first solo exhibition quite early in her career at the Corcoran Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. in 1977. She has since received numerous awards, including several National Endowment for the Arts, National Endowment for the Humanities, and Guggenheim Foundation grants. And her work is held by major institutions internationally, including the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the MoMA, the Whitney, and I'm proud to say this museum. In 2001, Sally Mann was named America's Best Photographer by Time Magazine, and her work is represented by Gagosian Gallery in New York. She has been the subject of two documentaries, Blood Ties from 1994, which was nominated for an Academy Award, and the feature film about her work, What Remains, in 2007, which was premiered at Sundance and was nominated for an Emmy for Best Documentary in 2008. Her many books include What Remains from 2003, Deep South from 2005, the Aperture titles, which are At 12, 1988, Immediate Family from 1992, Still Time from 1994, Proud Flesh from 2009, and The Flesh and the Spirit from 2010. In May of 2011, Sally Mann served as prestigious speaker at Harvard University for the William E. Massey Massey Senior Lecture in the History of American Civilization with a series entitled If Memory Serves. She expanded the Massey Lectures into a New York Times bestseller, which is the subject, of course, of tonight's presentation, Hold Still. Met with universal critical acclaim and named a finalist for both the National Book Award and the Andrew Carnegie Medal for Excellence in Nonfiction. For a review of Hold Still in the book forum, writer Claire Massoud describes Sally Mann's work as fierce and glorious images that have made her among the most acclaimed artists of our time, and also writes, who knew, quote, who knew that she could as easily have been a writer as a photographer, end quote. And I have to say that that was my experience also in reading the book and reading Hold Still. That and the lesson that as an artist, that an artist can lay claim to her career by clinging to what they find real and in both their subject and place. A reassuring lesson, I think, for artists both young and old. So with that, please join me in welcoming Sally Mann.
Roll up my sleeves here. What a fabulous museum you guys have. You are so lucky. I mean, I live in Chicken Switch, as you'll hear. And we don't have places like this, so you guys are just incredibly lucky. So many people in the line tonight said, I can't wait to hear your lecture. This isn't a lecture, but you're probably better off not getting a lecture from me anyway. And we couldn't decide. We went back and forth about what chapter to read tonight, and we decided to read the chapter on Cy Twombly. It's a little longer than the chapter on Dallas, but, you know, Cy is a special pet of mine, and you have the most, one of the more gorgeous bronze sculptures that he ever made sitting in your lobby. So I think it's completely appropriate. If that suits you guys, it's, you know, it's not the shortest chapter in the book. Y'all okay with that? Yeah? Okay. All right. So this is called, oh, I need a light here. Do I have one? Yes. All right. So this is called The Remove. And for the longest time, I had a subtitle, Lexington, Cy Twombly, and Working Outside the Art World. And maybe we should lower the lights a little bit if John's... Thank you. In the summer of 1973, 4 years before the deaths of Larry's parents, he and I returned to Rockbridge County for good. This was our third year of marriage, following my sophomore year at Bennington and junior year studying abroad, where we held each other close, broke and lonely, throughout our travels from Great Britain to Greece. Lying on the empty beaches of Paros, the remote Greek island where we washed up that spring, we stared out at the storied Aegean while homesickness sucked our starving hearts right out of our chests. Even after all we had seen in our year of travel, Rockbridge County was still the most beautiful place we knew. We were certainly not alone in this opinion. Travelers on I-81 frequently pull off at the Lexington exit to get fuel and, while gassing up, gaze in wonder at the landscape. Then not a few of them restart their cars and head directly to the realtor's office. It is a testament to the allure of the area that the artist Cy Twombly, who lived and traveled in some of the world's most beautiful places, chose to live half the year in Lexington, his hometown. In writing about Cy's work, the late critic David Sylvester cited Paul Klee's depiction of artistic creation, which he said was analogous to a tree's growth. Nourishing sap from the roots flows through the tree's trunk, the artist, and enriches the crown of growth, his resulting work of art. While the crown does not exactly reflect the roots, existing in a completely different element, it nevertheless forms a mass equal to them, just as a great oak is said to require the same amount of space below ground as above. Sylvester implies that Cy's early experience in Lexington, like the root system of that oak, quietly but essentially informed and enriched the crown of his art throughout his life. Cy seemed to concur, saying to Sylvester in a 2000 interview, quote, "Where I'm from, the Central Valley of Virginia, is not one of the most exciting landscapes in the world, but it is one of the most beautiful. It's very beautiful because it has everything. It has mountains, there are streams, there are fields, beautiful trees, and architecture sits very well in it. I've found when you get old, you must return to certain things in the beginning or things you have sentiment for or something. Because your life closes up in so many ways or doesn't become as flexible or exciting or whatever you want to call it, you tend to be nostalgic," end quote. The phrase, "Twombly returns to Lexington," recurs chorus-like throughout Nicholas Cullinan's detailed chronology of Cy's life in the last pages of Cycles and Seasons, the Tate Modern's catalog for its Twombly show of 2008. In fact, there is hardly a year of his life that he did not visit and for many years live and work in Lexington. And he got a lot of work done here. For example, the epic saga of the 52-foot-long painting, untitled Say Goodbye, Catullus, to the Shores of Asia Minor, now at the Cy Twombly Museum in Houston, came to a triumphant conclusion in a warehouse across the street from our old house on the industrial side of town. The tripartite painting was begun in Rome but remained unfinished for 22 years until it was shipped to Cy in Lexington in 1994. I can remember many afternoons walking to pick up the kids from school and seeing the tall, slightly stooped, densely overcoated and stocking-capped figure of Cy making his way down from his home on nearby Barclay Lane to the warehouse. It was probably the only place in all of Lexington big enough to house such an enormous painting, but he had to share the space with the table saws, paint cans, sawhorses, and wood shavings belonging to a local contractor. One Easter weekend, Cy unknowingly got a little help with the final panel of the piece from a 17-year-old carpenter named Josh Campbell, who had come to the warehouse to prime some siding laid out on sawhorses next to the painting. Halfway through the job, Josh was surprised to see Cy, about whom he knew nothing, ducking in through the far door with some sort of army satchel over his shoulder, prepared to work. Recapping his paint cans, Josh offered to leave, noting the greater magnitude of the job left for Cy to do on his project. Ever the gentleman, Cy demurred and insisted that Josh keep on priming the boards, saying he would be back later. After he left, Josh, who himself worked by the job, glanced at the great expanse of canvas, much of it as yet unpainted, and thought he could help the poor guy out, since it was obvious he had a long way to go on it. Setting down his big paintbrush, he picked up one of Cy's small brushes and set to it, helpfully adding some paint to the third panel, which at the time had, as he put it, just a few big balls on it. He signed his efforts in tiny letters, JMC. Once the big canvas was finished and shipped off to the Gagosian Gallery for its New York debut, the JMC now largely obscured, Cy rented a small, glass-fronted storefront in downtown Chitlin Switch, as he affectionately called Lexington. It was on Nelson Street, one of the four streets that composed the town's elemental hash sign layout. An unlikely setting for a studio, being right on the street, it gave the lie to Cy's general proclivity to live and work, quote, in a palace, but in a bad neighborhood, as a friend had once remarked. This place was no palace, it was a dive, but in a good neighborhood, within walking distance of his house, and notably next to a restaurant with treacly pecan pie. I photographed in that studio on many occasions, in part because of the coquettish quality of the light peeking through the tightly shuttered plate glass windows, and in so doing, documented, almost by accident, the artistic extremes of Cy's productive last years, the mind-storming rapture of the canvases contrasted with the calm intelligence of the sculptures. He seemed able to get a lot of work done in that funky place, as he remarked to his friend Sir Nicholas Serrata, the director of the Tate Gallery, quote, "My favorite cycle is Sesostris. I started them in Gaeta years ago. They were 5 or 6 years on the wall, and then I took them to Virginia and finished them there. I finished a lot of things there," end quote. How, I don't know. The lights were buzzing green fluorescence. The temperature control capricious, the drop ceiling low, and the noise level high. But all the same, he got it done. When I first began photographing in his studio, I remembered how Alfred Stieglitz, by making the altogether too perfect images of Brancusi's sculptures, provoked Brancusi to grab up his own camera and overexpose, blur, and generally screw up his way to photographic sublimity. Likewise, casually shooting with his dime store Polaroid in the same space where I had Stieglitzly labored with my 8x10 view camera, Cy made affecting images of his own work, especially the sculptures. In doing so, he brought me around to a Brancusi-like freedom of interpretation, and over the years, my work in his studio changed from documentary to evocative. In the earliest work, I simply wanted to record how Cy laid out his workspace. The studio was then uncluttered enough to pass through from front to back. In just a few years, jam-packed with sculpture, paintings, books, and junk from the antique mall, that same pristine space was barely traversable, joyful in its excess and misrule, flicking a casual bird to the compulsives among us. When Cy reciprocated by photographing in my studio in late 2007, he zeroed right in on the small areas of Cy-like disarray and made good use of them with his Polaroid, which in his hands made profound even the most mundane of junk heaps. Junk heaps in general he loved, and come springtime we would drive through the countryside around Lexington, stopping at the yard sales that sprang up along the roads like unnaturally fluorescent new vegetation. So it might seem odd that Cy would also love the highly regimented dress parades at VMI, but he did. Every Friday, the entire corps of cadets forms up in pressed white pants, sashed with maroon, and topped with bronze-buttoned gray coatees. Low on their brows, they wear an anachronistic shako dress hat, sprouting a waggling phallus-like pom-pom, which the cadets call a donkey dick. Cy delighted in the pomp, the donkey dicks, the crenellated barracks in the background, looking like a Mexican War theme park, the melancholic wheeze of the bagpipes, and oddly enough, the orderliness of the proceedings. It's not so odd when you think about it. Growing up as he did under the influence of the chivalric code and the lore of doomed military culture, it is no surprise that he responded to those parades or that we see an occasional martial strain in his work, Lepanto, 50 Days at Ilium. I believe many diverse elements influenced Cy as he grew up here and that they came to be reflected in his art. The blaze of southern light on Lexington's columned buildings, its cultural grace and languor, the region's literary heritage, its pervasive sense of faded grandeur and venerated historical myth. As he put it once in a local interview, it all came from here. All those columns, there are many, many things I never would have done if I'd been born somewhere else. The VMI parades were best in the spring, by which time the Corps had mastered the steps, and Cy almost never missed them. He loved the spring in Virginia the way I do, with a hectic rapture at the beauty of it all. On pretty days, we would sometimes ask to be driven to the Walmart store, built on a commanding hilltop, where he could sit out on the benches by the exit doors and watch the spectacle of shoppers and the sun rays sweeping across the Blue Ridge Mountains in the distance. The light and mountains, the breezes and the green of the May apples, the warmth of the sun finally soaking into the earth and into his sometimes painful bones. Being in Virginia gave him great sensual joy. It gives joy to many of us, irrespective of the old bones or of the generation. The experience of growing up here is timeless and universal in certain ways. Cy's childhood experiences were remarkably similar to my own, despite the 24 years that separated us. Like most southern white children of a certain economic and social class, we were both reared by black women whom we adored. I would wager that the woman who cared for Cy, whose name was Lula Belle Watts, gave him the same childhood experience of imperishable and bounteous love that I received from Gigi. Lula was only about 13 when she went to work for the Twombly family, and Cy, at that time, was a toddler. So unlike Gigi and me, they were relatively close in age. And much later in his life, when Cy was in town, he and his driver, Butch, would frequently take Lula out for a spin in the country. Lula, then in her 80s, still dished out her kick-ass lessons in proper manners, turning from the front seat, pinching a cigarette between her thumb and forefinger, and scolding Cy like a backseat child. It's hard to imagine that Cy would need a manners tune-up from Lula, as he, much like my southern father, was exquisitely courtly, cultivated, and courteous. As Cy put it to Sarada, quote, "It's very funny, but when I grew up, you always had to say yes, ma'am, and yes, sir, and you were never to talk about yourself. Once I said to my mother, you would be happy if I just kept well-dressed and had good manners, and she said, what else is there?" End quote. Cy grew up on tree-shaded Edmondson Avenue, just off Main Street and around the corner from Mrs. Lackman's preschool. My parents, who moved to Lexington when Cy was 14, must have met him soon after they arrived, because this delicate little sweetie of a sculpture, dated 1946, was given to them by Cy, a senior at Lexington High School, when he came to dinner at their house on Washington Street. After they moved to Boxerwood in 1951, it found a home in the clutter of the living room bookcase and was soon thereafter joined by one of Cy's house paint and pencil paintings, bought in 1955 for $150 while he was living in Lexington and teaching at a nearby women's college, Southern Seminary. Other people in Lexington also bought Cy's work, including the reclusive Jack Roberson, who used to sit outside his unpainted Boo Radley-esque house on Jefferson Street and offer blowjobs to the W&L students on their way back to the frat houses. I ran into Jack one Friday afternoon in the early 90s at the Stonewall Jackson thrift shop, located across from the bank in the basement of the seedy Robert E. Lee Hotel. He was struggling down the thinly carpeted ramp that led to the thrift shop with two brown paper bags, the big kind with the handles, one in each hand. The bags were stuffed to capacity and apparently heavy, judging by the difficulty Jack was having even on a downhill slope. When he achieved the basement floor, he pushed his way between the racks of jersey wrap dresses and shoulder-padded blazers and set the bags, their contents covered with newspaper, next to the checkout counter. Having gotten everyone's attention, he wiped his brow in exaggerated Jack fashion and addressed his audience in a voice alarmingly high-pitched at the best of times, but now beginning to trespass upon the dog-howling range. "The damn fucking bank," he announced, "had to choose this particular day to take a holiday, and now he was going to have to spend the entire fucking weekend at home with all this cash money he'd gotten for selling that Cy Twombly painting he had kept behind his sofa for 40 fucking years." Only in an honest little town like Lexington would Jack Roberson be finally able to deposit that money, both bagfuls, early Monday morning. It's a naive little town, too. When Cy's mother, his last living parent, died in the late 1980s, his sister called Cy and asked him to come and get his stuff out of the attic so they could sell the house. Apparently, Cy didn't realize the urgency of the request, or maybe he just blew it off, but everything in the attic was eventually gathered up and handed over to a local auctioneer. The resultant Twombly auction was held one Saturday afternoon in spring 1988 at the Busselberg Baseball Field behind the Route 252 dumpsters, about 3 miles past our farm. It's a desolate little patch of land, the base is barely visible in the scrub, an abandoned-looking cinder block building behind the torn and sagging netting at home plate. In that building, the residue of Cy's young life was spread out on long folding tables, boxes of papers, toys, and juvenilia of all kinds, as well as later stuff, paintings, photographs, and sculptures. There were two roughly foot-square gouaches from the late 1940s, one of which was an unusual orange color, but in bad shape. The other was in good condition, and an antique dealer responded to the call of the auctioneer by raising his hand. He bid $1. Nobody else bid, but a friend of mine, observing the proceedings, felt it was disrespectful for a painting to go for $1. So he raised his hand and ran the price up to $34, forcing the dealer to cough up $35 for the painting. When a half dozen Rauschenberg boxes came up for bid, painting and adorned with feathers and bones, quote, "weird magical things," my friend said, the crowd laughed out loud at them. Naturally, nobody bid, so he bought one for 50 cents, another for $1, and then for a few more dollars, he picked up a cache of subtle, still-life photographs from Black Mountain College by both Cy and Rauschenberg, some of them of Twombly paintings that had been destroyed. Parenthetically, several of these photographs my friend recently made available to the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts. This is fitting, since it was a Virginia Museum Professional Fellowship in 1951 and 53 that funded Cy's travels to Black Mountain in Italy. For years after the Busselberg sale, Cy went from one local antique store to another, then broadened his search over the mountains into the Piedmont, asking after any sightings of a little painting he had done in his childhood, which was special to him, and a toy he had loved, a sailboat. Both had sold at the auction. The warehouse in which Cy completed the 52-foot-long painting was one of those charmless metal affairs that spring up practically overnight in industrial parts of town. But from our house, we couldn't see it unless we walked up the driveway to the road. We had bought our little plot of marginal city land back in 1975 with the hope of putting up a blacksmith shop for Larry, who had become interested in metal sculpture in college and was sharpening plows, welding farm implements, and forging hand-wrought chandeliers for a living. Or something less than a living. While Larry worked with ninth-generation blacksmith Manly Brown, I had a somewhat more lucrative position as the photographer for Washington and Lee University. It required only a 35-millimeter Nikon, but that didn't prevent me from trotting out my white Samsonite suitcase and setting up my 5x7-inch view camera to the complete bemusement of the sports team I was there to document. At least we had a paycheck coming in, and when that raggedy scrap of dirt-cheap city land came on the market, we thought we could afford it. It was in an ugly part of town, forbiddingly steep, overgrown, and trash-strewn. The whole town thought we were crazy. In fact, the man who sold it to us, the owner of a local taxi service, told us after the ink had dried on the contract he thought we were crazy, too. It lay below the old railroad line, an abandoned rail station that served Lexington until the 1940s, at which point the track was used only for freight and finally torn up in the 60s. Something about the place must have seemed so bleak and unredeemable, even back then, that conductors and train crew felt it perfectly appropriate to toss onto this pathetic patch of scrub the train's accumulated refuse. Crockery, empty bottles, bent silverware, clothing, ice boxes, satchels, broken push brooms, umbrellas, and curling leather boots in which we expected to find the skeletal feet of a dead hobo. The Lexington residents followed suit with their trash. Since the late 1800s, our land had been the unofficial city dump, its steep hillsides a cascade of more modern trash atop the train trash, and the flat bottomland mounded with dozens of honeysuckle-covered X-taxis, paradise trees grown up through the windshields, snakes coiled in the seat springs. We had nothing except energy and hope, and set to clearing and hauling a century of garbage from the land, hacking down the trash trees and scything through the multiflora thickets. We made a few pleasant discoveries. Hidden behind all the overgrowth was an undernourished creek augmented midway by a watercress-rich spring, which in turn was fed by the hillside of garbage, but we chose not to think about that. We toiled for a year to reveal a view of the creek and to clear the spring, sweating and itching with nettle stings, slicing our souls each morning on the shards of glass that emerged from the ground like some particularly malevolent nocturnal plant form. I had a vision of how I wanted to live. In 1969, my parents and I had visited Helen and Scott Nearing on their subsistence farm in Maine, and I had made a heavily underscored mental note that this was exactly what I wanted for myself. A life of simplicity, pluck, seclusion, and soul-satisfying, ecological, sweat-of-the-brow will vote with our lives, self-sufficiency. 7 years later, Larry and I were giving it a go. By 1977, we were digging by hand the footers for an impossibly perilous cliff dwelling, and then for the next half decade, we scavenged building materials for it, learning as we went. By the time Cy moved back to Lexington in 1993, the resultant spindly, hand-built, Rube Goldberg-like passive solar house had bulked up with a succession of shed-roofed add-ons, living areas cantilevered out over the abyss, and labyrinthine porches covered with vines. A commercial pilot we know once remarked that from the air, our house resembled those shanty towns on the edge of the Mexico City dump, and we were not offended. It was a totally cool, Big Sur-ish house. Impractical, whimsical, not to code in any respect, the kind of place that stopped passersby in their tracks and lured them, cautious and curious, past the basilisk sculptures to our slabwood front door. So I, too, would wander down from the warehouse to that door, calling out in his distinctive, hesitant voice, "Sally, are you receiving?" We both liked to sit out on the wisteria-covered back deck, overlooking the creek, especially on those sultry summer nights when the fog rose from the bottomland and wisped among the race seams of white bloom. One such night found a group of us with Cy and Nicola, his gentle, erudite companion, sitting after a late dinner on that porch, the newspaper-covered table, nacreous with oyster shells, bottles of wine darkening the center. I mentioned my fast fascination with Ezra Pound, an American who, like Cy, had found Italy his place for starting things, and about whom I had written my master's thesis. At this, Cy, sitting to my right at the head of the table, leaned over to me with a look of confidence about to be divulged, so I pressed close. When Cy was about to tell a story or make a naughty quip, he would cover his mouth in a schoolchild's way, fingertips lightly touching his primly pursed lips, while above them the eyes were alight and impish. I watched memory veil those eyes as he spoke of a time in the late 1960s when he and Nicola had been invited to the Spoleto Festival by its founder, Giancarlo Menotti. That evening, a Russian pianist was performing, and Menotti honored Cy and Nicola by seating them in his private balcony in the opera theater. As they took their seats, they were startled to see behind them Ezra Pound and Olga Rudge, one of the three women with whom Pound had simultaneous relationships. Cy described Pound as having an aura, a mystical appearance, and as being somehow set apart from regular people. Nicola wrote me later that Pound, quote, acted extremely shy, like only a northern blonde child could be. He hardly looked at us, and in a side way, end quote. Telling me of this in the humid summer night, Cy emphasized how rare it was to see the reclusive poet who seldom appeared in public in those later years. Pound had been driven mad, or perhaps more mad, by his wartime incarceration in